And turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, and we'll be in the 12th chapter, the very end of the book. What people who study the book would call the epilogue or the afterword. Verses 8 through 14, the very end of Ecclesiastes. We have a lot more people here this week than we've had for many weeks through the summer, so I will review. If you've been here all summer, you're laughing because every single week I've reviewed. There's different faces here each week, especially through the summer. So Ecclesiastes is a sermon. The very first things that the book tells us, it says it's the words of the preacher. And I don't know about you, but most preachers are known for preaching sermons. So Ecclesiastes, the book itself, is a sermon. We shouldn't divide it up. Now, we have divided it into about 13 weeks, but the view of it we should see is one sermon. And a sermon normally has a text, it has some points, it probably summarizes, and then it finishes, has a conclusion. And that's what Ecclesiastes does. So it's a sermon, it's the words of a preacher, it's a little bit different type of a sermon. For one, it's written in very poetic or poetic language or prose, and so it uses terms that are a little more vague to us and even more little vague to those that originally got it. It's poetry. And then the other thing about it is that it's inductive. Now, I've tried to explain inductive reasoning from week to week, and I was thinking about it again this week. It's not that it's hard to understand, but it's not the way we normally think. And some you might say that inductive reasoning starts by showing and then concluding, and deductive reasoning starts by telling. Okay, so deduction tells you something and then shows you why, and inductive reasoning shows you something and then concludes something in finally. So the text of Ecclesiastes is chapter 1, verses 2 through 11, I believe it is. Yes, 2 through 11. And to summarize that, the preacher tells us there that life is empty. He uses the word vanity over and over and over again through the book. But he's looked around. Everything that we can see in life around us turns out to be empty. And it's meaningless. There doesn't seem to be any reason for everything that we see. And so that is his text. If life is empty, what should we do? What do people do? And he begins to go through and show us what mankind has done to try to fill the emptiness in their life. As a human race, you might have not have chosen one of these, but we're all drawn toward them in different degrees. And so he first goes to the idea of knowledge and wisdom and shows us that if a man could get all the knowledge that's available, all the knowledge, he would still find that there's emptiness, that life is empty. And then he shows us that if it were possible for a man to obtain and experience all the pleasures, every pleasure to the nth degree that pleasure is allowed to be enjoyed, at the end of it, there would still be emptiness, vanity. And so, and these are areas that mankind seeks after. Some of us like to, you know, we think that if I just learn some more, then I'll know the answers. Some of us say, well, forget all of that learning. I'm just going to enjoy myself. And the world very much so lives for pleasures, lives to just have fun. There's a tremendous segment of our economy is built upon just pleasure. I mean, millions, billions of dollars in baseball and football and hockey and all of those things, and that's just pleasure. It's all about pleasure. But I guess, to take sports as an example, the preacher shows us that if it were possible for you to lift the Stanley Cup with an NBA ring on your hand and all the other, and have a World Series, whatever they get, and all the Olympic medals from every contest, if it was possible for you to do it all, it would still be empty at the end. Still be vain, vanity. And throughout his sermon, he brings us to some partial conclusions, and after those first 2 points, he says, and these partial conclusions are generally similar in that they say something of, along the lines of, it's better to live joyfully. It's better to live joyfully. And then he begins to look at business. Some people get tremendous satisfaction out of work and accomplishing something, whether it's in the business world or in public life. They get tremendous satisfaction out of helping others, perhaps, or feeling like they are helping others, having power in society, in government or public life. So business and public affairs, but the preacher shows us that even if you could build or accomplish everything there is to accomplish, whether it be in business or in public or government type affairs, at the end of it, you'd still be empty. And kind of concludes along the way that we ought to joyfully live where we are. Then he begins and talks about wealth, and that's something that I think is stronger in everyone. These other things you might say, well, I'm not one of those learning guys. I like the pleasure or whatever. We're drawn toward things in different ways, and maybe there's somebody here that's not drawn toward wealth, but it seems to me that the Bible teaches that all of us have a real strong tendency toward money and things and wealth. And he shows us, the preacher shows us, that a person could have all the money in the world, basically. He could have all the wealth that's needed so that there's not a thing in the world that he couldn't get if he wanted it. And yet, wealth doesn't satisfy. At the end of it all, you're still empty, still wanting. And if you want, you don't have everything. Wanting is emptiness. And then you could say, well, kind of to me, in contrast with that, is a person that just says, well, I'm just going to live a life of moderation. Just be kind of conservative about things and not go too far after this and not too far. I'm not going to seek all the money in the world, but I'm not going to give all my money away. You know, just a little in the middle there. I'm going to be a good person, but I'm not going to just live my whole life toward being a good person because, you know, nobody can be perfect. But I'm not going to be a bad person. But if I do a thing wrong here or there, it's no big deal. Just living a life in the middle. And that, to our ears, is obviously a big error. And even that, if we live that life of just kind of thinking we're going to just sit in the middle, we end up with very bad conclusions about life, and that leaves us empty too. And one of the other conclusions that the preacher draws along the way is that we should just enjoy what we've been given before God. So after he goes through basically those six areas of humankind, he then re-summarizes some of those, and then he begins his conclusion, which we started 2 weeks ago in chapter 11. And generally, he concludes with, two weeks ago we said charity, industry, and perspective, and then last week we said rejoice, reflect, and remember. I'm going to bring those together and say that generally his conclusion is that we ought to be charitable, industrious, and cheerful. Okay, charitable, industrious, and cheerful. And all of those are possible because of the perspective, the reflection, and the remembering. Those perspective, reflection, and remembering are all connected in the judgment, in the after, in life after death. And so life here under the sun would be charitable, be industrious, be cheerful, because of what will happen when the sun goes down. And that's kind of funny, it's kind of a humorous way to look at it, but people say that, doesn't it? I mean, that's the way we refer to life. We're in the dawn of life, in the dusk of life. We have hymns that we sing that talk about the evening of life. So while the sun's up, life under the sun should be charitable, industrious, and cheerful, because the sun's going to go down, and there's things with perspective. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the idea of judgment. And if you recall, if we were to think, I want you to think about the commands and the, what would we say, curses or threats that God gave the children of Israel. I dare say it's hard to think of a threat or a curse that would not be fulfilled here on earth. So you do this, I'm going to send oppression. You do this, I'm going to send disease. You do this, I'm going to send famine. Now you may be able to think of something that's not, that is not here on earth, but the majority of the laws that the Israelites knew and understood referred to punishment for wrongdoing in the present, here, as the preacher would say, under the sun. And I say that to say that that meant that in their thinking, the judgment was not something to be afraid of. Okay? God would judge you, punish you for wrongdoing here. Most of future judgment would be a relief from the inequities that did happen here. Okay? In the people who first received these words, that's the way they thought of judgment. Okay? They had been under oppression, and the judgment would be a time when God would make things right. He would sit there with true justice and make things right. And I want to point that out because that helps us understand what the preacher is getting across and has been getting across even in those in the last two lessons when he talks about reflect. Remember that that God will judge. Well, that remembering that God will judge is basically a remembering that if you're doing right, God is going to judge those that aren't doing right, and it looks like things are going just fine for them. He will make things all right in the judgment. So the preacher's conclusion is that we should live a life of charity, giving, a life of industry, working. We should work whether it looks like it's going to rain or not, right? The clouds come by and he's like, well, I don't think I'll plow my field today. No, a Christian, somebody who believes in God and wants to live for God is going to work regardless of things around him. He's going to give. He's going to throw his bread on the water, the water's just going to soak into the bread and it's going to sink down to the ground. You're not going to get anything back from it. We don't know where it will come back from, but we know if we're charitable, an evil time will come and God will take care of us from a place where we didn't even expect it. We will work and we should be cheerful. And all of that is because there will be a future judgment when all is made right. And so we come then to verse 8 of Ecclesiastes chapter 12, and this we're calling the afterword, or the epilogue, if you're more of a literary person. Afterword and epilogue mean about the same thing. So he's finished, he's concluded, and now he's going to say one last thing. Verse 8, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. Now, he's not saying what I just concluded is vanity also. He's just kind of saying, remember, the whole thing has been about how life is empty. Okay? So he's reminding us of this life down here that is empty. And then, new paragraph, that statement stands by itself. And then he says, and moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the master of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. And further, by these, my son, be admonished of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. So I think the second thing he's saying in this afterword is that the truth gives meaning. I'm going to bring that out some, but the truth gives meaning. Life is empty, it's full of vanity, emptiness, but obviously he doesn't you know, everything is empty, but that statement that he just made that everything is empty is full of meaning, isn't it? Okay, there's a little, irony going on there. And so, actually, he says, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Now, we've said that if we pursue knowledge completely and all the way to the end, we're going to find that it's empty. But the preacher is wise, and he's still going to seek knowledge. And this is where I mean truth has meaning. It helps to make sense of life. And so this preacher was wise. He taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed, and he sought out and set in order many proverbs. So he tells of himself and says that he read a lot. He studied a lot. He sought out and looked for proverbs, and then he put them in order. And what we just read or what we just heard, if he was speaking it, is the result of those labors of seeking and setting in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. So what he has written are words of truth. And those in truth helps to help us to make sense of life. You know, if you seek knowledge completely, if somebody says knowledge is the end of everything, that's not true. And he just told us that, didn't he? He showed us that at the end of that is still empty. I'm not going to go through all of those things, but that's the point. He is gathered and put together all of these different things. He sought the writings of others, wrote some himself and brought them together and set them in order so that it would present us with the truth, upright, even words of truth. And the truth then makes sense, helps us make sense of life. But it also pushes us to do what we ought to do. See there in verse 11, the words of the wise are as goads. Now, I think I was listening to, I was walking through Sunday school a couple weeks back, and they were talking about, they must have had this verse to learn or something like that, and they were talking about goads. And what was a goad? We know what a goad is, right? Or if you've been in Sunday school for a while, you know, you might not know that the shepherd would have a stick, and on the end of that heavy, it was manageable, but sturdy stick, he'd put a nail or something sharp to push the livestock in the direction they ought to go. Now, I can imagine. Well, I can't imagine. I don't want to imagine. If I was a livestock and I was going the wrong direction, getting pushed in the right direction, it pricks us. Now, the truth does that, doesn't it? It ought to do that. When we read the scriptures, it pushes us. It might prick us. If we're kind of already going sort of that direction, it doesn't hurt as bad. Right? If we're kind of obstinate and I don't want to do that, I'm hiding from the Lord. It doesn't sound like McConico. It didn't seem like he got pushed really hard. He seemed like maybe he was willing as soon as he got just the first poke. But the truth pushes us. And we ought to realize that if we stand obstinate, it's going to keep pushing, and it's going to get harder. It's going to hurt more. So the truth pushes us to do what we ought to, but then it also holds us in to where we ought to be. So the truth, it will push us, but it will also hold us in. Because the next phrase says, the words of the wise are as goads and as nails fastened by the master of assemblies. Now, a nail fastened by the master of assemblies was more like a tent peg, that kind of a nail. He's got an assembly together, and he's setting up a tent so that why? So everybody stays in the room, okay? And that's the idea with this. So the truth can push us to do things we ought to do. It can also hold us into where we ought to be. We come to church, and throughout the week we heard something. We thought, that's a pretty decent idea. I kind of like that idea. And we come to church, and the preacher preaches, and all of a sudden the Holy Spirit says, you know that idea you thought was kind of a good idea? It's not a good idea. Stick right here. We have that happen to us, don't we? Yeah, we hear some conservative talk radio host, and he says something that's really sounds really sharp and interesting, and said, "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah," and we start saying what he's saying, and then we come to church and we hear, "Well, actually, even though that sounds good, it's not really the truth. The truth is this," and it holds us in. Well, and I say conservative, most of us tend toward that, but whoever you listen to. I mean, you can just listen to popular radio, and they're kind of try to be wishy-washy and accepting of all things, and you come to church, and you find out that we shouldn't be wishy-washy and accepting of all things, whatever it is.